Okay, welcome everyone to this fine winter's morning in Second Life. Today's talk, as many of you may already be aware, is going to be about on the topic of sex, drugs, and rock and roll. I've wanted to do this talk for a while, and I haven't gotten around to it. I think probably it was before I went away to Thailand, and then I went to Thailand, and I'm only just getting a chance now to address the issue. Because I think it really gets to the heart of where a lot of people's minds are. Especially in a place like Second Life, that this is obviously a place, it has many facets to it, but one of the pulls is the entertainment value. And not only on Second Life, but in the modern era, these three topics, I think, are some of the most important issues from a spiritual point of view to address. It's important that we have some proper understanding about these things, these three topics, sort of fairly related topics. And so I thought I'd talk about them. I think there's a lot that we can learn and that is useful from discussing these three topics. It may not seem like it, and in fact it may seem that these are three things that a Buddhist monk should never talk about, that they are not in the realm of Buddha Dhamma. In fact, I bet you'd be hard-pressed to find a Buddhist monk in a traditional Buddhist setting who would ever dare to talk about these things. But I'm not really in a traditional Buddhist setting, so often we have to adjust our adjust our means and the medium or the sorts of things we talk about to be appropriate for the audience. And I think a modern Western audience, we have to talk about the very core values and ideas in a materialistic society. And so these three, I think these, it's incredibly important to talk about these three things, as well as many other things, related issue, topics. And I'll get into why that is. But the first thing I wanted to say is that, because really what I'm going to be trying to explain is that there is that there's a problem with these three things, that our insistence and our ideas and our views that these are good and proper and beneficial is somehow a misunderstanding. So I want to say in advance, as I've said before in other talks, that in Buddhism you don't have to believe what I say, and it's not a matter of whether you accept my views or not. But rather, in the Buddhist teaching we examine things, we analyze. It doesn't mean we think about or we rationalize or we use logic, but we actually look and investigate. and try to understand reality. So the point here should be an examination or acquiring tools, acquiring a sort of a framework by which we can examine reality. And this is incredibly important, examining reality. And this is going to play a crucial role in understanding things like sex, drugs, and rock and roll. Because there are many people who in modern society will hold a view. Not only do they enjoy sexual activity and drugs and or alcohol and so on and music, but they also believe that they are beneficial. They hold a view that there is benefit that comes from this. I think that's a widespread view, in fact. In fact, I think probably many people would hear me say this and think I'm a little bit daft to even suggest that this is a view, that this is only an opinion. Because for many people, this is reality. This is the truth. And yet what I would propose is that a honest investigation of reality shows something a lot more complex, a lot quite different from this idea of the benefits of these things or the intrinsic quality and virtue of sensual enjoyment in general. Because we don't see that people in a materialistic society are happier, are more at peace, are more free from suffering. In fact, for those of us who have traveled, who have done any degree of traveling, even within one's own country, I would say, what you find is that the further you get away from materialism and sensuality and promiscuity and so on, at least insofar as going into the village where the countryside, where or to countries that have still not been developed technologically, where it's a natural abstinence, where they just don't think about these things. It's never been a part of their lives. You'll see that they're much, much more at peace, much calmer, much happier. Now, this is a good example in the case for those people who have not yet come in contact with sensuality in the intense manner that we do in a materialistic society. Or in a developed society. But I think the argument, one argument that people will often use, and the accusation that is often leveled against Buddhists and religious people in general, is that the practice of spirituality is merely the repression of one's desires. That one can never truly be free from desire, since, of course, we say it's genetic and it's a part of being human, it's natural, we have these words. These views will become, the discussion of these views will become very important. It'll become very important to understand these views and to examine them, to see whether they stand up to reality. But what they say is that what you're doing when you practice meditation or when you deny these things is simply repressing them. And, well, we all know what that leads to. And that's the qualifier. I said the further you get away from sensuality and people and the indulgence, that more happiness you find. And that's only true when it's a natural abstinence. Among those people who abstain consciously it is something that they're attracted to, even addicted to, but they abstain from it, you tend to find a lot of suffering. And this is, on the surface, proof that the abstention from sensuality is a bad thing. And if we didn't have this example of natural abstinence, of traditional cultures that engage in sensuality in great moderation, on quite a lesser level than we find in developed societies, that you'll find this happiness. So, since we have this example, we have to ask ourselves, well, then what is the truth? You know, what is the reason why one can abstain from these things and be happy? And what is the reason why the abstention from these things leads to suffering? And the reason here is because there are three ways we can react to any given phenomenon. And this is a meditation teaching. This is something that has to be understood through meditation. At the moment when we experience something, we see, we hear, we smell, we taste, we feel, or we think, even right here and right now, we will react in one of three ways. One, we will be attracted to the experience. Two, we'll be repulsed from it. And three, we will experience it neutrally, experience it without judgment. Perhaps because we don't recognize it, or perhaps because we understand it. And this is how we approach things like sex, things like, generally, let's say sex, because it's the most obvious. It's the one that we do find people in the world repressing to a great degree. I mean, this is a taboo subject. It's something that we call dirty. We say it's, filth and so on. It's a subject not to be disclosed, not to be talked about in public. And so we see that there are these reactions too. Sexual desire, that we like it, we think it's a good thing, or we repress it. Now, the third way of approaching reality, and this is what is really going to allow us to understand it, is simply experiencing it. Experiencing the whole of the sensual experience, or the desire for sense objects, experiencing it as it is. Because we have these results, and we could probably do a survey on them, where we see where happiness lies. Does it lie among those people who indulge more in sensuality, or does it lie in those people who abstain from sensuality? And what we'll see is that it's not clear that you gain happiness from things like sex, drugs, and rock and roll. And so we have to ask ourselves, well, where does happiness lie? We are indulging in these things in the hopes that it will bring us some kind of benefit. And we generally think that we're gaining some kind of benefit from them. That that there is an intrinsic value in sensuality, in sensual experience. Now, the views that we have are what support this. We have these views that, well, let's start with sex. We'll go through them in order. That it's a part of nature. That it's a part of being human. That it is the proper behavior for a human being or for beings. You know, even that it's the ultimate intimacy and so on. And all of these views that we have, all of these ideas that we have, are quite unscientific. Because in fact, if you look at the reality of it, there is none of this comes from the nature of the experience. That the reason why we develop the views that we do is because we aren't seeing things clearly. We have only a rough estimation of reality based on our past habits and our past experiences and the memories that we have. We recognize certain stimulus as pleasant, as pleasurable. And so we chase after them, and we develop this actually a cycle of addiction. The truth of any act or any experience has to be understood in terms of science, in terms of scientific principles, in terms of the nature, the true nature of the phenomena. So when we say that something is natural, when we say that something is good, that it's that it's proper and so on, we have to ask ourselves, what do we mean by that? And even when we say something that something is the nature of human beings, or we are human beings, therefore we should engage in this activity. Well, we have to ask ourselves, what do these words mean? What does it the human being mean? And in what way are we to identify with this concept of the human being? Because in fact, according to reality, that's all it is a concept. We are not human beings. The concept of a human being is a construct that is used in science, in material science, as a means of classifying certain physical structures. That this is a human being, this structure is a human being, this structure is a dog, and this structure is a cat, and so on. But our experience, the experience of the individual, admits of no such classification. Our experience has nothing that says to us that it's human being, that we are human beings. There's only this recognition and this concept that arises in the mind, along with all of the other experiences that we have of pleasure and pain and desire and aversion. And so the first important thing is to separate our assessment of reality from our views. Okay, when we come here to talk about these things, we should be able to put aside our views. No discussion, no investigation, no understanding of the truth can occur when a person is holding on to a belief. In other words, a view that is not is not derived from investigation of reality, something that is taken on through reason, through partiality, through belief, through faith, or so on. And the same is in regards to the Buddha's teaching. So the Buddha said that when you give up desires, when you give up all of your attachments, this is where happiness comes from. But this shouldn't be taken on belief. This is something that we can investigate. This is a guidance. And we can try and experiment with the Buddha's teaching and see for ourselves. The faith that we gain is because we see that it's true. And we see that when we approach all types of sensuality with sexuality at its head, that we will see that it is merely a physical process of experiencing and then feeling pleasure in regards to, as a result of the experience, recognizing the experience as something that brings pleasure, and then experiencing pleasure as a result, being pleased by it, liking, and finally becoming attaching to, wanting or craving and intending to get more and to build up and to create. So much of our lives, in fact, is spent in the pursuit of these things, chasing after sensuality, running away from displeasure and unpleasant situations, and chasing after those things that we find pleasant. And we actually go through a lot of stress just to get these objects of our desire. And when we look at it scientifically, we can see that actually it's all one and the same, that there's nothing special about any sensual experience, that it goes through this causal chain. We see things, we hear things. All of our experience can be broken down into sight, sound, smell, taste, feeling, and thought. And then the recognition of the experience as something that brings pleasure or something that brings pain. When we see someone beautiful, we become attracted to them. And by beautiful, the meaning is someone that there is the recognition that this type of physical form brings pleasure. This type of physical form, when contacted, will bring a pleasant experience. Because see, this is where genes come into it. This is where the physical body comes into it. That there is a physical part to addiction, the physical side to it. That when a human being in general, when a man sees a woman or when a woman sees a man, there is the response that brings pleasure. There is the recognition that this is this is an object of desire. This is a object of sexual attraction, and then the brain kicks into its addiction cycle or its chemical reactions, giving rise to adrenaline, giving rise to hormones, testosterone or estrogen or all of these hormones that then give rise to a great amount of pleasure. So even just seeing a beautiful person brings about this desire, this recognition that that object is going to bring me pleasure. Even before we've experienced the pleasure, right? And this goes with food, this goes with pictures or with anything that you see. It can go with hearing about someone. When you hear about someone, how a person is beautiful like this or that, or you hear about this delicious food, or you hear about something pleasant, even just that experience of hearing something or seeing something can bring pleasure. So you see food and you haven't even eaten it yet, and already you feel some kind of desire. You want this food, even though you haven't tasted it yet, because of the memory, because of the cycle. So when we practice meditation, when we look at reality in this way, we will begin to see things quite different from before. We will come to see that there is the physical and the mental aspects of the experience. When we see something, there is the seeing, then there is the recognition, then there is the pleasure. Once there is the pleasure, then there is the liking of the experience, and there is the wanting, and then there is the striving, the chasing after. There is the partiality that arises. Now, the reason this is a problem, this cycle of addiction really is a problem, is because we can't always get what we want. The Buddha said there is the suffering that is intrinsically suffering. There are those phenomena that are intrinsically painful. But then there are those other phenomena that are painful because they change, because they're impermanent. And so the funny thing about human beings, about people in general, one of the things that really causes problems and stops us from becoming enlightened, really, is our ability to fool ourselves. Our ability to deny reality and to ignore reality. Our ability to ignore suffering and to not learn from our mistakes. To not learn from other people's mistakes. To not see the truth. Our ability to delude ourselves. Because if the statistics are there, the examples are there. People who kill themselves over romance, people who kill other people, you know, the romantic triangles and fighting, and why people beat each other up. Very often it's over romance. People will become bitter enemies. The example of adultery, the pain and suffering that comes from a broken family, from a divorce, that based on adultery and so on. All of this is there. Even the research on addiction, the comparison that we can make to a drug addict, and of course I'll get into drugs next. And finally, the evidence that no one has ever gained any, there's no one who can describe an intrinsic benefit to sensuality. You know, we always say, this makes me happy or that makes me happy. But, well, what good is it? I mean, the question really is, are you a happier person as a result? Are you more at peace with yourself, more content, more satisfied, or less satisfied? That's really it. Are you more satisfied or less satisfied as a person, as a result of these things? And we can see, if you look at your situation, for many of us, this is a difficult question to answer because we feel quite satisfied. We feel like we've got everything we need. Many people in this world don't feel very much suffering. But if you look, first of all, at people as a whole, or you look over the long term, well, people who have lived their life like me, how have they fared? Where have they gone? What have their results been? You'll find some horrific conclusions that many of these people have had to seek therapy for their mental problems, for their addictions, for their for breakups, for low self-esteem, and so on. That is all based on living this life of sensual addiction. The evidence is all there. I mean, this isn't something that should be a view or a belief. But you see how we ignore it, because we live like, one of my teachers said, we live like ducks or chickens in a pen. And if you've ever been on a farm, you know that these animals look and act quite content and quite happy. And if you're able to talk to them and you ask them, you know, how's it going? You know, how's life? They would say, oh, not bad, you know, we have to live in this pen, but we get all the food we want, and you know, well, here we are fighting and playing and, you know, acting as if they, you know, they were going to live forever. Without a clue of what's in store for them. And so we live like this as human beings, not realizing what's the potential future. The other thing is that we ignore our own suffering. And this is an important something that we have to really confess to ourselves, that in fact we do have suffering in our lives. Because there are many people who deny this. They deny having much suffering in their lives. There are people who deny getting angry, people who deny ever feeling sad or depressed or so on. But there are very few people who are successful in drowning out the negative side of life. Because really what you're doing when you engage in a cycle of addiction, our attachment to sights and sounds and smells and tastes and feelings, is in a sense setting yourself up for the fall, because you're creating partiality where part of existence, part of reality is pleasant, is proper, is good, and as a result the rest of reality is not that, is not pleasant, is not gratifying. It's not getting you what you want, and scientifically this is incredibly easy to see, because, well, first of all, because of the way the brain works. The chemicals in the brain actually stretch the system. They stress the system. So the more positive chemical stimulus the brain receives, the more chemical stimulus it is required the next time around or in the future as the process continues to create the same amount of pleasure, the same amount of satisfaction. So what is the choice here? You can't. There is no static state of gratification. It's not that we can find a way of maintaining a state of this state of bliss or this state of pleasure. We either find a way to moderate it, where for most of us we spend most of our lives working to support our stable lifestyle. So we have to do many unpleasant things in order to engage in gratification of sensuality. Or suffer the inevitable fall of not getting what we want, through, you know, through if we go the route of intense gratification, through trying to get more and more and more. And first of all, this balance is incredibly difficult to maintain. You'll think that you can maintain it for some time, but you're still engaged in this cycle of addiction. And when something, when it comes to a head, when the opportunity to engage in, first of all, extramarital sex or to increase the gratification, one will generally take it because the current amount of gratification is no longer sufficient. And this is why addiction is not static. It becomes more and more of a problem as time goes on. Or one will suffer the results of perhaps someone else's infidelity or the changes of the world around oneself. So the stability of one's life suddenly comes crashing down. You lose your job. You can no longer enjoy this, the objects of your desire. There's theft and disaster and sickness and so on, which takes away your stability of life and this so-called stable existence. It's living in a very precarious way, because the gratification of sensuality is not satisfying. It's not something that you can say you get it and that changed you somehow, so now you don't need to receive it again. It changes you in the opposite way. You can't look back and say, I've gained so much sensuality and that's made me so much more happy and so much more content. The more you indulge in it, the less content you are, the more you need. And this is a physical process. You can look at the brain and you can see this occurring. Because the truth of sexual activity or all sensuality is that it's a process going on in the brain. It doesn't have to do with even the other person. The intimacy that you feel for other people, the love you have for them, that has nothing to do with what we're talking about here. And we should be clear about that as well. When we talk about relationships and people who love each other, the love of the relationship is something totally different. And that is in fact a positive thing, obviously. It's something that leads us to help others, to bring happiness to others. But the sensual side of it is empirically a dangerous thing. It's something that leads to our disadvantage, something that leads to our suffering. We can't maintain this level of pleasure, and the happiness that comes is not satisfying. So in meditation, it's important to understand that we are not trying to repress the experience. When we want something, this is why it's important to talk about these things, because our general tendency is to repress them. When we want something, we shouldn't repress it. The Buddha said, as a last resort, if you simply cannot overcome it or come to terms with your desires, your wants, your addictions, then repression can be a temporary solution as a last resort. But it's not a permanent solution. This is something we as Buddhists should understand, that our goal is to overcome these things. These are not things that will lead us to hell or to be born as an animal or so on. They're not things that are intrinsic or they're not a violation of basic morality. They're not really unethical in a basic sense of the term, or in a general sense of the term, in the sense of being evil. But they're disadvantageous. They're dangerous. They are things that do in fact lead to our dissatisfaction, and incline only towards suffering. They don't lead towards satisfaction, they don't lead towards peace, they don't lead towards true happiness. And so as Buddhists, we try to approach these, we try to examine them, we try to understand them, we try to overcome them. But there's no overcoming of a pleasant experience through, or a desire, let's say, through repression. It's only through understanding. As I said, there are three ways of approaching an experience. Cultivate it, repress it, or accept it. And accepting it is in two ways. One is through simple ignorance. And this is why people who have never experienced sensuality are not addicted to it. This is why people who live in the countryside are not addicted to the same things as people in the city, because they don't recognize these things. There's no recognition in the brain as something that's going to bring pleasure, and in the mind as something that is going to bring the physical chemical reaction. There's not that recognition. There's not that association. Just like when a human sees a non-human, they're not attracted to them. You're not attracted to members of the opposite gender of other species, because there is no recognition there as something that is going to bring pleasure. But in Buddhism, we are trying for a different kind of acceptance, and that is the understanding. The understanding of the nature of the addiction, for those things that we are addicted to, that we do desire, that we do enjoy, we're looking for simple understanding of them. We're not trying to deny it. We're not trying to repress it. We're trying to understand it. And if through understanding it, we see that desiring it is a positive thing, then by all means, if it's positive, then we should cultivate it. No? Unfortunately, or fortunately for the meditator, what we see is that these things are not satisfying. There is no intrinsic benefit or intrinsic quality, even to a pleasant feeling. Even a pleasant experience, a pleasant feeling, is in the end only an interpretation of a physical experience. A physical phenomenon, something going occurring in the brain, occurring in the various parts of the body. It's an interpretation of those experiences that is very much a part of why we are human beings, why we are stuck in this compressed reality. As I said before, the reality of a human being is really just a concept. That reality is something much more vast, much more incomprehensible. Our part in this universe is unfathomably deep. It's profound. It's much more profound than this human being, this human reality that we find ourselves trapped in. This a small pale blue dot, you know, that has led the atheists to feel humbled, you know, because our human existence is so insignificant in the universe. But then you think, well, it's kind of a shame that I only have this 80 or 90 years to experience such a profound universe. And so they're always striving to experience more and more of it in this lifetime through outer space travel or so on. But they'll never get to even a small portion of the profundity of the universe. But in fact, we are a part of it. We are a part of this reality. We are a part of this unfathomably profound reality. That is who we are. This human existence is created by our coarse views and beliefs and ideas and addictions and attachments, our enjoyments and our creation of an identification with increasingly more and more coarse existence. Being a human being is not a part of the reality that we find ourselves in. The reality is experience. And experience goes very far beyond this human form, this human shell. So when people talk about the how great sensuality and sexuality is, it's really because of their limited understanding or their limited appreciation of the nature of the universe. That true happiness has nothing to do with pleasurable physical contact. Physical contact is just another experience in the flux of experience of our being. And we through the meditation practice, we come to understand this, and we come to lose our grip, lose our cling to this form, to this being, to this construct that we've created. And we're able to rise above it and come outside of it and find true satisfaction, true peace, and true freedom from suffering. So this is some thoughts on the concept of sexuality, that it's important that we see it and put it in it the proper light, that it's a constructed phenomenon that is based on this constructed existence of the human being that has been created over time. And it is only closed-mindedness that is keeping us attached to this specific experience, that our belief that this is a part of who we are and so on, because it really is. It's a part of who the I that we've created, identification that we've established with our human form. But when we open our minds, when we look objectively at the experience through the meditation practice, we will naturally let go of this. We'll come to see that it's a misunderstanding. It's something that we've cultivated, this wrong understanding, over lifetime after lifetime. And we'll rise above it. And so it's important, the important point here is that we should not try to repress these things in our meditation practice, because this is often the reaction that comes when someone starts to practice the Buddha's teaching, understanding that this is not the way to true happiness, and therefore feeling angry and upset when one wants certain things or desires things and so on, feeling guilty, feeling bad, feeling sinful. And then as a result of that, feeling like perhaps this sort of practice is wrong, feeling averse to the Buddha's teaching because of this misunderstanding that somehow the Buddha taught us to repress these things. It's most crucially important for us when we practice meditation to come to accept, come to see things as they are, accept our desires, accept the pleasure that comes from things. Never deny that a pleasurable experience brings pleasure. It does bring pleasure. But when you examine that pleasure, the way out is to see the pleasure for what it is and to not place any value judgment on it as good or bad. Not to chase after it, but also not to suppress it. Simply seeing that there is pleasure, seeing that there is desire, seeing that there is the experience of sight, sound, smell, taste, feeling, and thought. Okay, this is, I think, enough about sex. That's about the most I'll probably ever talk about the subject. It's not one of those subjects that monks talk about. The second subject is drugs. No. Drugs, I think, are in some ways a lot easier to discuss. And so I'm not going to go into great detail. I'm going way over time here already. So there are many kinds of drugs that it's easy to understand are bad. You know, the addictive drugs, cocaine, heroin, these have been, it's been accepted that they are negative, I hope. I think most of us can accept that the dangers inherent in these things are so obvious. The great thing about these sorts of drugs is they provide a great, very clear example of the process of addiction. And the mistake that we would make is to think that they're somehow any different from our ordinary experience of the world. It's only a matter of degree. The stimulus that comes from taking heroin is different from an ordinary sensual desire and pleasure. Only in the matter of degree, the stimulus is much more intense. That's all. And so overcoming drug addictions, whether they be hard drugs or soft drugs, even overcoming cigarette addictions, is actually done in the same way as how we would overcome our addiction to sensuality in general. Through understanding, through seeing the addiction as it is. And we get often, I think we become misled by science, and perhaps it's partially intentional, because oftentimes psychotherapists want to sell us drugs or want to sell their therapy or so on. And so as a result, they give all these theories and ideas about how it's something that you can't overcome, right? If you can't overcome it, then you need to go to see the doctor all the time, right? You have to go through therapy, and you have to see your therapist all the time, and you have to take these drugs and go through these programs and so on. And that can be a real moneymaker. I think there is that factor involved. But I think in generally, we just simply are misled by science, because science in the modern era is very much materialistic. It focuses only on the physical aspect of addiction. And when you look at the physical aspect of addiction, there's not much you can do about it. You know, it is what it is. The addiction is just going to get worse and worse and worse. But obviously that's not the truth. That's not the whole of the truth, because the mind plays a part as well. It doesn't matter how addicted physically you are to a drug. You can break out of it at any time if your mind is clear. If you see the experience for what it is. If you can see the desire, you can see the pleasure, you can see the experience of seeing the cigarettes and wanting the cigarette, taking the cigarette up, tasting the smoke. If you clearly see all of these phenomena, you can be addicted to heroin or addicted to cocaine or addicted to any sort of drug and overcome it in really a very short time. The problem is, of course, that our minds are not strong, and we can't just in one day come to see things clearly. But this is really the only true way out of addiction. And that is through understanding, through seeing the addiction for what it is. Through seeing the reality of it, that really we don't have an addiction. And this often becomes a problem as well, that we get this idea that I am addicted. And we associate with the addiction, we associate with the states of experience, and as I, as me. And then we feel guilty, we feel like a bad person, so we hate ourselves, and we build up this identity of I, who is the addict, and how bad we are, and in what a bad position we are, and feeling sorry for ourselves, right? We've totally lost sight of reality, because we create this self, and we'll repress the feelings and so on, repress the addictions and try to run away, even try to kill ourselves to be free from it, right? Because we have the idea that it's the self that's addicted. So killing the self kills the addiction, which of course it doesn't do. But there are other drugs, and this is worth mentioning as well. There are other drugs that people say are actually beneficial towards one's spirituality. There are also those drugs, first of all, those drugs that people say are not harmful to one's spirituality. Many people say that alcohol is not harmful to one's spirituality. And I would say clearly those people have never practiced meditation, because it takes very little alcohol to disrupt your meditation. And I'm sorry, I think there are people out there who don't agree with this, and it's sad, really. But you can only say that those people are still missing a basic understanding of how the mind works, a basic appreciation of how the mind works, that they haven't gone to a deep enough level to appreciate what alcohol does. Because anyone who has, even just a little bit of alcohol, will make them feel mentally handicapped, that they've lost their clarity. Meditation is, in one sense, the ultimate sobriety, or enlightenment is the ultimate sobriety. We're striving for true sobriety. Clarity of mind is just another word for sobriety. So anything that takes this away from us, whether it be marijuana or alcohol, is only to our detriment. It's not something that's going to help us to become enlightened. And so this is where we get into those drugs that people say are beneficial. There are hallucinogens that people say are beneficial. Even marijuana, many people say, is beneficial. Even someone just recently, I was on the internet and I logged into a Buddhist chat room, and this guy was drunk. If you can believe it, he said, "I'm drunk, but I think meditators should drink once in a while." Maybe he was lying, but I don't see why. And it's amazing to me that he would log into a Buddhist chat room and when he was drunk and start talking about it. But you know, drunk people will do anything. We have to really be exact about what we mean by spiritual development, because there are a lot of drugs out there that can, in fact, as a side effect, bring about some spiritual benefit in terms of understanding a more deeper understanding the universe on a deeper level. There are experiences you can have using psychedelic drugs that are quite profound. In terms of seeing other worlds and opening your mind up to new ways of thinking. Because, of course, they mess with your mind. They mess with your brain. And as a result, your mind does think in different... You do think in different ways as a result of these drugs. And that's what I was saying. That's very much a part of reality. That reality is a much more profound thing than we understand it to. There is perhaps even limitless different ways to think and ways to see the universe. Different ways to form a being or our existence. And yet the point is that none of these really bring enlightenment. They don't bring understanding of that experience. We can experience heaven, we can experience hell, we can experience extraterrestrial life or so many different crazy things that can come from psychedelic drugs that will supposedly open your mind up to the existence of these experiences. But that's all it is. It's the experience of these altered states of reality. It's not the understanding of them. And in fact, the understanding is taken away because of the effect the drug has on the mind, that it's actually disrupting one's mental framework, the fabric of one's mental reality. I mean, being a human being, we have a fairly stable brain and mind and experience of reality. taking the psychedelics is actually a distraction. The result is that you can see things that you didn't see before, which will open your mind up. And it has some benefit in terms of helping you lose your grasp on this very confining human existence. But it doesn't allow you to understand those things. In fact, it prevents your understanding in many ways because of the distraction and because of the effect that the chemicals have on the brain. So it's important that we understand when we talk about the benefits of psychedelic drugs or any kind of drugs, is what we really mean by benefit. Does it really help you to understand the experience in front of you for what it is? Does it help you to let go? Does it help you to simplify reality, simplify your experience of reality? Or does it complicate it? Or does it just confuse and entangle you up in some new way of identifying with self and with experience as me and mine and so on? So this is drugs. I think we will see when we practice quite easily that these things are not of the benefit that we think them. If we are honest and as I said, open-minded, and looking at things scientifically instead of based on our views and our beliefs and our opinions, we'll see that there is no benefit that comes from these things. That they don't help us to understand, and therefore they don't bring this freedom from addiction and ultimate contentment and peace. Finally, the last one is rock and roll, and I'm over time, so you're welcome to all get up and leave if you want. I'm just going to keep on talking. Rock and roll. Well, talking about music. Music is something that I think is the most controversial. As I said, all sensuality is within limits. Is not unethical. When you might even say that a little bit of alcohol and a little bit of maybe even a little bit of marijuana once in a while isn't unethical, because you're not hurting anyone. You know, you get stoned or you get drunk and then it's gone. It's over. If you're careful. A little bit of it in moderation, it doesn't hurt anyone. It's not going to send you to hell or so on. You know, sexual activity isn't going to send you to hell. It's within reason. Yeah, if it's not hurting anyone else, then you can think, well, it's not really unethical. And music is even more so, because it's hard to fathom an unethical behavior arising from music, unless you get into hard heavy metal or some rap music that encourages these sorts of anger and hatred and bigotry and prejudice and so on. No, but when we're talking about music, we're talking about the musical quality of a song. And so we have to distinguish. I'm not going to talk about the words, the lyrics, the meaning of a song, because that can be had from any medium. Here we're talking about the medium, and that is the rhythmic, melodic quality of music. And this has many levels, or it has a couple of different ways that it impacts who we are. The first way it impacts who we are is it creates desire, it creates enjoyment, and it does create addiction. Music is something that we do become very much addicted to. And we become addicted to seeing no danger in it. And it's sad, really. But that's the way it is, and that's the way it is for most of us, myself included. I had a great music collection a long time ago, and I gave it up when I meditated, and it was a lot of suffering for me to have to give it up, because that was something that really brought pleasure to me. But the reason it's sad is because life has a rhythm to it as well. Reality has a melodic quality to it as well. It's just that it's far more complex. And it's not a static rhythm, it's one that changes. It becomes more harmonious as we do. It becomes more chaotic as our minds become more chaotic. And I realized this when I was, far before I was studying Buddhism, I was living in the forest and I would make maple syrup in my parents' maple forest. And I remember sitting there, listening to the sound of the maple sap dripping into these buckets, and the sound of the snow melting around me, and the sound of the chipmunks. And it was just this very simple, ordinary experience, but had a far more profound impact than any song, any melody could ever have, because of the harmony, the nature, the natural quality of it. That there was very little there. There wasn't this intense, artificial, contrived beat and melody. This was real. This was reality going on around me. And that's why I say it's a shame, because due to our insistence and our addiction, our obsession with artificial, with contrived, with intense gratification, we miss the reality around us. And rather than creating a more and more peaceful and harmonious state of being, our state of existence becomes increasingly more and more chaotic. You know, look at the room around you and ask yourself, how have I come to this state where I'm living in a box, staring at a plastic screen, listening to sound come out of some speakers, some metal boxes, metal, what have you, speakers. And so what we hope to gain from the meditation, again, we're not trying to repress this desire, this enjoyment, but through understanding and through seeing the music as simply a part of nature, and not attaching any more significance to a musical beat as to the sound in the room around us, or the sound of nature, the sound of reality, of the reality here and now, that we're going to simplify, we're going to give up, we're going to stop intensifying our experience, we're going to de-intensify, we're going to simplify and expand our experience, expand our reactions towards reality. Anyway, I don't want to go too much longer, but I just to wrap up here, that again, the most important thing is for us to see things as they are, and it's not important to believe that something is wrong or something is right. And as Buddhists, this is an important teaching, I think, something that we have to stress, that we're not benefited by chasing after these things, by encouraging them, by indulging in them. But we can also be harmed equally by repressing them. And so it's important to talk about, it's important to examine, it's important to accept these desires in us so that we can become free from them. Anyway, thank you all for taking the time to listen to me today. And I hope this has been of some benefit and that you're able to put some of these concepts to work, that actually they can be of some benefit to you and help you to see reality for what it is, and to not become addicted and more obsessed with these things. I hope that you're all able to put the Buddha's teaching into practice, and that you're able to find peace, happiness, and freedom from suffering through it. Thank you all. If you have any questions, I'm happy to take them now. Otherwise, have a good day.